Hello and welcome to the Alzheimer's Solution Show. According to the Alzheimer's Association, Alzheimer's disease is the only cause of death in the top 10 in America that cannot be prevented, cured, or slowed. But what if it is preventable? Ralph Sanchez believes Alzheimer's can be prevented in some cases, especially if you look at your risk for Alzheimer's disease long before a diagnosis that is not reversible. Ralph Sanchez is a functional medicine specialist with 20 years in the field as a practitioner and consultant, and he's author of the forthcoming book, The Diabetic Brain. I'm Bonnie Wagner Stafford, and on the Alzheimer's Solution Show, Ralph Sanchez and I will explore the latest research on what contributes to your risk of developing Alzheimer's and how you and your loved ones can best protect yourselves. Today, in the second of a three-part series on the first chapter of the forthcoming book, The Diabetic Brain, we're going to continue to explore the model of Alzheimer's as brain diabetes, or type 3 diabetes, and the underlying factors that might raise your risk for dementia. Hello, Ralph.
Hi, Bonnie. Thanks again for facilitating this podcast show.
You're welcome. So when did you first start to see research that described Alzheimer's disease as type 3 diabetes?
That goes back to about the year 2005, 2006. And in fact, in 2005, a study came out that described the Alzheimer's disease neurodegeneration component that was a type 3 diabetes model. It was coined in that study. And what they were noticing in their research was that there was reduced levels of insulin and a dysfunction of insulin and the receptors there in the brain that appeared to be like a diabetes. It had aspects of type 1, which is low insulin levels, and aspects of type 2 diabetes, which is brain insulin resistance, as it's termed in the literature. And with that, they said, well, this looks like a diabetes model. We're going to call it type 3 diabetes. And subsequently, a lot of research started to develop over the years that I followed very closely on that. And then a few years later, as I saw more and more of this research emerging and already had seen a lot of links that put cardiovascular disease and obesity into the mix of an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease, I started to realize that this was really becoming an emerging model of Alzheimer's disease, where there is an underlying issue related to metabolic problems in type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Genetic variants that raise the risk. And this was also a pool of risk factors that lent to this type 3 diabetes model. And I was just fascinated with that whole story and research and continued to follow it very closely and wrote an article about that that's on the AlzheimerSolution.com about brain insulin resistance and its relationship to Alzheimer's disease. And subsequently, not long after that, it dawned on me that this is what I really wanted to focus a lot of my research on and develop a book around it, which is becoming The Diabetic Brain.
Cool. So that first research that you started to see 10 years ago was kind of the first sign that scientifically there was a recognition of this heart-brain connection, and that's becoming kind of more of a mainstream acceptance, would you say?
Well, the heart-brain connection is a little different. So the type 3 diabetes model really has to do with insulin function in the brain. But there is also a heart-brain connection that's been gathering steam, if you will, and being recognized as a significant component to increasing your risk for dementia and or Alzheimer's disease. So what happens is in obesity and heart disease, you're upping your risk for vascular dementia because of the disease process inherent in both of those problems. Heart disease or cardiovascular disease is a problem with vascular function, and that vascular function eventually migrates into the brain with reduced circulation, an occurrence of what are called TIAs, and possibly stroke. And that happens to be a really prime terrain for developing a vascular dementia. And then you add type 2 diabetes to that, because type 2 diabetes and heart disease are connected. And they start to combine together and produce a host of insults to a very vulnerable brain that intensifies your risk not only for vascular dementia, but for Alzheimer's disease. For example, studies have shown that type 2 diabetics have a 50% higher risk of developing late onset Alzheimer's disease. And I want to make a point that when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease in these shows, we're talking about the late onset form. There is an early onset form that is genetically determined in terms of it manifesting. Usually happens earlier in life, before 60. It could happen as early as your 40s, 50s, and late onset Alzheimer's disease comes on after your 60s. And as you increase in age, your risk actually increases with it, the risk for Alzheimer's disease.
And those two, the late onset and the early onset, is that the only difference between those two is the time at which they manifest and start to show symptoms, or are there other differences as well?
No, it's the genetic component that really separates that. So if you have the genes for early onset Alzheimer's disease, you are going to develop that sooner or later. Whereas the genes related to late onset Alzheimer's disease are simply risk factors. Late onset Alzheimer's disease is promoted by a host of risk factors, and genetics are only one set of those risk factors.
Okay, that makes sense. So we're talking in these shows about the late onset, sometimes referred to by the acronym LODE, and there is a definite connection with respect to risk factors if I'm someone who has a type 2 diabetes and even a little bit of cardiovascular disease, would you say?
Well, type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease go hand in hand.
Right.
Once you start developing type 2 diabetes, your risk for heart disease goes up 2 to 4 times. And so as the disease progresses, you inevitably are going to wind up with cardiovascular disease complications. And so when you put 2 and 2 together there, type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, then the disease process is associated with both as a big ball of wax. Mm-hmm. Sets in motion a whole cascade of events that again puts your brain in a very vulnerable place. They both have a very pro-inflammatory face to the disease process and a related issue that is referred to as oxidative stress. And we'll talk more about inflammation and oxidative stress in show number 3. Oxidative stress is a very, very important element in chronic degenerative disease processes, and so is inflammation. And these two factors is what is repeated over and over again in the research literature as the underlying features of these chronic disease processes and what places the brain for a much higher risk of neurological disease. So again, if you are at high risk for vascular dementia because of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, then if you put genetic risk factors on there like the APOE4 gene, which is a variant of the APOE gene, and that's what we discussed a bit in show number 1. If you add the APOE4 variant into that mix, then you start to have a much higher risk for late onset Alzheimer's disease. And oftentimes, the vascular dementia or late onset Alzheimer's disease is a mixed syndrome. So sometimes it's hard to differentiate which one is which. And genetics have a lot to do with whether you're ultimately going to develop Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. I'm going to ask a couple of fairly basic questions, but mainly because I want to make sure that I understand this and that folks at home listening can understand this too. You've mentioned a couple of times vascular dementia. Is that different in how it manifests significantly from a cerebral kind of dementia? Is it kind of the same thing if either myself or a family member is experiencing either one of these disease processes? Is it going to be any different based on whether it's vascular or cerebral?
Well, it is actually both, because what you're having is a disorder that is cardiovascular in nature and eventually starts to manifest as cerebrovascular disease.
Right.
And cerebrovascular disease is ultimately what starts to manifest as a vascular dementia because of the mechanisms associated with the disease process of vascular disease or cardiovascular disease and cerebrovascular disease.
Okay.
That's what happened to my mother. She had metabolic syndrome, which was not adequately addressed by her physicians. And over time, because of the metabolic syndrome features and the hypertension, she started to develop vascular dementia. And the vascular dementia process, as I mentioned previously, can ultimately manifest as an Alzheimer's disease if one lives long enough, or it's going to be a mix of both things. So now we know that vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease are often concomitant features of that disease process.
Okay, that helps. You also mentioned that there is a brain insulin resistance that happens when we're talking about type 2 diabetes and whether it's coupled with the cardiovascular or not, but that this actually has an impact in cognitive health. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Absolutely. So again, as I said, you know, in 2005, this was first classified in terms of an appearance of a type 3 diabetes model in the brain where insulin was not functioning. There were lower levels of insulin, and the insulin receptors didn't seem to be functioning adequately enough to respond to insulin. So that was classified as the type 3 diabetes model and a form of a brain insulin resistance. So let me go into that a little bit more to clarify what that's all about. So insulin in the body plays a very, very important role in terms of the uptake of glucose. It controls glucose levels in the body, right? So once insulin is signaling in the cells of the muscles and liver and related tissues, it's going to allow for glucose to enter the cell. And over time, in the type 2 diabetes disease process, if you're secreting too much insulin because of dietary factors and others, you start to become more insulin resistant. The higher levels of circulating insulin in the body eventually exhaust the insulin receptors, and so they don't respond as well to the insulin, and you become increasingly more insulin resistant. In the brain, that's really different in how it occurs. It does not have to do with circulating levels of blood sugar and the cells there becoming more insulin resistant. It has to do with a disease process that's related to what are called amyloid proteins. And these amyloid proteins in the early stages are peptides. And as these peptides aggregate, they go on to form the classical hallmark lesions that are called amyloid plaque associated with Alzheimer's disease. But early on in that whole upregulation of the formation of these amyloid peptides, they start to interfere with insulin function at the synapse. And that's really the key to insulin function in the brain. Insulin does participate in some glucose uptake in the neurons, the brain cells, But really the key aspect of insulin function in the brain is all about a signaling aspect. So insulin is very, very important. It is neuroprotective, and it is a key element in memory formation and learning, which is all facilitated by insulin and insulin receptors and other receptors at the synapse. So in essence, insulin binds to these insulin receptors at the synapse, and then it initiates a whole cascade of signaling mechanisms that are vital for synapse maintenance and the subsequent strengthening of these critical communication junctures, the synapses between the neurons. So brain insulin and insulin receptor signaling are requisite mechanisms in the maintenance and the survival of the synapse. And the loss of synapses is now viewed as a hallmark correlate in the cognitive decline that characterizes Alzheimer's disease.
So we're now talking about something that's quite different from a genetic link or genetic history, such as the early onset Alzheimer's that we talked about earlier. And now we're talking about things that sound to me like can be perhaps prevented if somebody is paying enough attention earlier on in their life. Is that the case?
I believe so, because if you look at the characteristics of the Alzheimer's disease risk and what those risks are in terms of genetics, lifestyle, diet, and other factors, if you can go into early assessments of those risk factors before they become an eventual problem in terms of the development of that disease process or Alzheimer's disease, then you're way ahead of the game. So there is now a clinical entity that's referred to as mild cognitive impairment. Okay, so mild cognitive impairment is now recognized as the early signs of Alzheimer's disease. So this can happen 10, 15, and even longer before the actual or eventual diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, where you can start to see and assess certain biomarkers that are related to the damage that is going on in your brain. Of course, the other risk factors have to do with the metabolic processes related to cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, that's now referred to as a cardiometabolic disease process. And if you control your risk factors there, and everybody knows that you can, it's a dietary and lifestyle disease issue. And if you really look at your diet and you exercise and you stop smoking and you moderate stress levels, you're really going to be in control in terms of how these diseases do or do not manifest in your body. And similarly, you're going to be in control in how they affect your brain. And if you combine that with looking specifically at some of these Alzheimer's disease risk factors, whether they be genetics or others related to inflammation and oxidative stress, then you can really start to take control. And you can start to take control by looking at these risk factors early on in your life. And if you're starting to have problems where you might be worried about some memory loss and loss of cognitive function, and you go to your doctor, and let's say you're in your early 50s, and you happen to be more proactive and wanting to take note of what's going on with your health and getting some assistance from a physician, then if they go through the steps and you're diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, you know that you're in the early signs of a very important evaluation that represents possible brain damage and the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. So mild cognitive impairment and certain types of it, because there's different types, is now recognized as the early stage of Alzheimer's disease.
Now, we probably don't want to get into a whole bunch of detail about what the signs are of mild cognitive impairment, but you certainly piqued my interest. So early to mid-50s, lots of jokes go around socially about when you hit that age, you start losing, common words and, forgetting little things. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about that should be a warning sign for somebody, or is it more significant than that?
It can be. So I have a great article that I posted at thealzheimersolution.com about mild cognitive impairment and how it can be the early warning signs of Alzheimer's disease. So that's a really important one to get a better insight into what we're talking about here and what that's all about. But yes, memory loss, that's huge. And just being unable to gather your words or remember where you put things. Those are all, they can be the early signs. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's brain damage, because hormones play a role, and nutrition plays a role and stress plays a role. But if you have other problems going on in your body, and what I've always told my patients and people interested in these topics is to look at your family history. And if your family history has dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and you're starting to experience some of these problems, it might mean that you're also on your way. And similarly, if you have a history of a type 2 diabetes or a cardiovascular disease in your family, and you're not in the best of health, then, and you're in your 50s, and you haven't started to take control, that's just going to continue to spiral downward. And eventually you could wind up with some dementia-like aspects to your health and how that manifests as you age.
So we've talked a little bit about watching for memory symptoms. We've talked about looking at your own family history. What about the role that laboratory tests might play? Is there anything that, maybe we don't detect anything in our day-to-day memory, and maybe we're not sure about what our family history is? Is there anything else that can tell us whether we should be making changes or trying to get something addressed, like lab tests?
Absolutely. So as part of a proactive process in working with a physician and looking at your health into a prevention model as you age, then it's all about looking at biomarkers. And biomarkers are these indicators of what's going on physiologically in your body. There are biomarkers of metabolism, there are biomarkers of inflammation and oxidative stress. And one tip I'd like to give those listening is that often in these blood chem analysis that doctors will use for their patients on a semi-regular basis, fasting glucose and another related biomarker that's called hemoglobin A1C. And they're related and they're very, very important in looking at how you age and your risk for a problem related to type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, and maybe even dementia or Alzheimer's disease. So hemoglobin A1C is a marker of glycation. So fasting glucose, as it rises, starts to indicate that your glucose handling, your glucose metabolism that may be controlled by insulin is not functioning that well, and it may be indicating that you're insulin resistant as you age. So the higher your glucose levels go, if they're starting to be in the upper 90s or even over 100, then you're really on your way. Similarly, hemoglobin A1C is a marker of glucose levels in the body. And when you're looking at that, if you are under 5.5, you're doing pretty well. So an ideal set point for that would be 5.0 and even less. And as you go up on that scale, anything over 5.7 or 5.8 is starting to indicate that you're glycating. So hemoglobin A1C is a marker of glycation. And what is glycation?
I was just going to ask that.
Glycation is where glucose or sugar starts to interact with vital tissues in the body. Now, to give a demonstration of how that might look in food preparation, a very popular method for making foods look better and taste better is browning or caramelizing foods. And that's food that are cooked at higher temperatures, and it's called the Maillard reaction. And it really represents the interaction of carbohydrates with proteins and higher temperatures. And that's a glycation process. And there's also evidence now that a higher intake of those types of foods also puts you at risk for problems related to inflammation and oxidative stress and the disease processes associated with that. So think charbroiled meats and those nice pastries that are browned.
Right.
Those are the glycated foods that in your body represents a glycation issue that's happening with sugar and proteins and fats in your body. And that's a very deleterious process because over time, the more and more you glycate, you will start to produce a more advanced molecule that's called advanced glycation end product, or AGES for short. It's a very appropriate acronym. So AGES is actually part of the aging process. You lose, you know, the ability to metabolize glucose and to have insulin function as you age for lots of reasons. And it can be accelerated as in the diabetic disease process. And hemoglobin A1C reflects what's going on there quite precisely. So when you're into that glycation mode, and you, let's say you're now going up over 6, we said that 5 was ideal. 5.5 is not so bad. 5.7, 5.8, you're starting to get into the upper ranges of what's ideal. And then if you go over 6, you are at increased risk. So 5.8 to 6.23, you're really at high risk of developing diabetes at that point. And if you're over 6.5, you are diabetic.
And those numbers can be found on a pretty standard blood test that the doctor would order when they're checking things like sugar and the cholesterol levels and those sorts of things. And they would be people would be looking for HbA1c notations on those tests?
Yes, HbA1c. HB as in boy, A as in apple, 1C as in cat. And that's a pretty standard marker that's available on blood chemistry tests. A lot of times doctors won't include it unless they suspect you may have problems with glucose metabolism. So if you go to your doctor and you haven't been there in a while and you haven't had a test for a while, and you should always have a fasting blood chemistry. I was always amazed when patients would come in and their blood chemistry reports weren't done on a fasting. Sometimes the office or the doctor will fail to ask patients to make sure it's fasting. And when you have a fasting blood chemistry report, it's going to indicate an accurate blood glucose and lipids, which are, you know, the cholesterol and triglycerides that need to be on a fasting state. So if you go into your doctor and you've done a fasting blood glucose and it's in the 90s, you know, a good doctor is going to start thinking, this person may be shunting into a problem with their glucose metabolism and their insulin. And so let's look at hemoglobin A1C and see where they're at there. You know, that's going to be a nice marker too. And now physicians that are very proactive, that are very progressive and are more in line with the functional medicine model. And we talked about functional medicine in the first podcast. But those physicians are going to be probably including hemoglobin A1C on a pretty regular basis. Because as I said, that's a marker of aging. The more you glycate, the faster you age. And the more you glycate, the more problems you're going to have with a disease process like diabetes.
So The doctors that are ordering these tests should be able to pick up on the changes in the numeric levels that come back on the report. But should we sit back and wait for a doctor to say, hey, your number is sliding upwards, you should, you know, maybe think about doing something? Or are people better served to take note of these numbers themselves and proactively ask their doctors questions about it and maybe even take more action than just asking questions?
Well, I think that unfortunately, you know, many patients or people, individuals, just don't know enough. You know, so they go to their doctor and they trust their doctor to really be very involved and perhaps investing in a prevention model. But that's not always going to be the case. So what I'm advising is to be very proactive and partner with your doctor and ask questions and ask for more biomarkers that may indicate issues that are going on with you that you may not be aware of that are the early indicators, early signs, whether it be glycation or inflammation or oxidative stress. As you age, these things happen naturally, all right, but they're going to happen in an accelerated state if you're not eating well, if you're not having enough antioxidants in your diet, you know, nice healthy vegetables and fruits that are loaded with anti-inflammatory and antioxidant molecules. If you're not eating enough of those, if you're not sleeping well, if you've got too much stress, if you have genetics that start to combine with all those factors, that's going to start to show up in these biomarkers. So if you start looking at them earlier, you're going to start to realize that you may be headed for some problems later on in life and that you can probably prevent a lot of these problems by getting into a very proactive form of healthcare. And healthcare is about, you know, being very proactive and looking at these things earlier rather than later. So our current medical model, which is insurance driven, fortunately, is not a healthcare model. It's a disease care model. So usually they come in when you have a disease and been diagnosed with a disease, and then they start to patch you up with drugs. So you don't want to get to that point, hopefully. You can have early forms of these disease processes that are reversible. So glycation is reversible. And the formation of advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, is not reversible. Those AGEs can cross the blood-brain barrier and put your brain at risk as it starts to interact there with other processes in the brain that are involved with inflammation and oxidative stress to accelerate a disease process there. There's a receptor for AGEs. It's called RAGE. So this is all sounding very appropriate.
It is.
AGEs and a receptor for AGEs, which is RAGE. R in age stands for receptor, receptor for AGEs. And so when AGEs interact with the receptor or RAGE, you start to initiate some pretty serious problems in terms of inflammation and oxidative stress. And when that starts happening in your brain, you start going into this downward spiral of a neurological disease process. And of course, there's a lot of other factors around that that participate in that. But ages in your body and in your brain are very deleterious. And if you can start noticing that you're glycating, you want to start hopefully reversing some of that glycation so that you interrupt the formation of AGEs. Now, the formation of AGEs is naturally, it happens throughout life, but you don't want to accelerate that and get that to a point where there's a lot of age-RAGE interaction and stimulating these disease processes associated with inflammation and oxidative stress.
Right. Well, that's fascinating stuff, and there's good tips in there for some self-care for people to be proactive around, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more in upcoming shows, more about things that people can do to reduce their risk. Coming up on the next Alzheimer's Solution Show, which is part three of our look into the first chapter of the forthcoming book, The Diabetic Brain, we're going to get more into the details of the pro-inflammatory aspects of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and type 3 diabetes, as well as a little bit more detail on oxidative stress. So thanks very much, Ralph, and thanks to our listeners. We will talk to you again.
Thanks again, Bonnie. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening to the Alzheimer's Solution Show. If you'd like information regarding Ralph Sanchez's consulting services, please go to the contact page of thealzheimersolution.com. Thealzheimersolution.com is your resource for Alzheimer's disease prevention and education information. Please tell others about the Alzheimer's Solution Show, and once again, thanks for listening.